This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Every week, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to our no-holds-barred forum for discussing what's good, bad, ugly, and just plain silly in the arena of doing business with the government. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is a new friend of mine, Steve Koprince. Steve is an attorney at Pettifish, Schimmel, and Heeb and Hurd. Is that right?
Pettifish, Schimmel, Heeb and Hurd.
There you go. More importantly, he's got a great government small biz blog, smallgovcon.com is the blog, and the his just released book is a must have for everybody, The Small Business Guide to Government Contracts. Great book. Everybody needs it on their shelves. You can get it pretty much anywhere. Steve, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate it.
It's wonderful to have you in studio because I know that in a month you're going to be in Kansas City.
That's right. That's right. I've been on the East Coast for many years now, but my wife and I had a baby girl and are looking to move closer to family, and that's the Midwest for us. So we're heading back to the Midwest, but I'll continue focusing my practice on representing small government contractors, because contractors are everywhere, and I'm happy to represent folks all over the country.
Well, and you don't need your attorney in D.C. if he's good, and predicated on my reading of this book, you know this small business stuff, so give us your background.
Happy to. I grew up, like I said, I'm a Midwesterner, born in Illinois and raised up in the cold tundra of North Dakota. When it came time to go to college, I decided to escape that Arctic wilderness and went to Duke University down in North Carolina. From there, it was up to D.C., where I had an internship with my congressman from North Dakota, and then after graduation, ended up working for him, and that's really where I first came in contact with the small government contractors and that industry and that arena, because one of the things that I did as a legislative assistant for the congressman was to help small government contractors in North Dakota, and that included ordinary small businesses as well as tribal companies, deal with issues that they were having with the federal government and help them work through it. And so that really kind of sparked my interest in that community. After a couple years there, I was off to law school at William & Mary, again in Virginia, and since then I've been working in the government contracts field. First started working with a larger firm that dealt both with large and small government contractors, but primarily with large. Wasn't sure I really liked that as much, but then it was on to another firm that dealt mainly with small businesses, and I really, really love working with smaller companies where I get to know the folks in charge and really can feel like I'm making a difference. And that's kind of where I intend my career to be for the rest of my life.
Kansas City is a federal executive board city, is it not?
I believe so.
Yeah. So number one, we know that the federal activity is there, so you should not be wanting for local clients. But I'm going to tie you back into my programs over at Capital College, because your expertise is well demonstrated here, and you don't have to come back to teach. We'll do it remotely.
Either way, I'm happy to. It's a pretty short direct flight.
There you go. How short?
It's about 2.5 hours direct National to Kansas City.
How about Baltimore?
I have never flown out of Baltimore, but because I live in Arlington, so that's National's a lot easier for me. But I'm guessing it's probably just as easy from Baltimore.
There you go. Maybe 5 minutes longer, or 10 minutes. Who knows?
Probably not too much, though.
Who's counting? All right, we have a number of issues to get through here, but I guess, you know, one of the things that pops up regularly, I'm having a conversation later on today with a small woman-owned business. We talked about that briefly before, but when might a or why might a small business not be considered small by SBA? And I want to get into size standards too.
Sure. This is a really an interesting question, and it's what I talked about in the first three chapters of the book. And I think it seems almost counterintuitive for a small business to think, well, I might not actually be small. But the SBA rules and regulations can be a little more involved and a little more complicated than folks often believe. And various business relationships that a company has can actually lead the company to be considered not small when, in fact, they've all along believed that they actually were. And so let me talk about a few of those things. First of all, the companies need to be able to know how to properly calculate just their own baseline revenues or employees, because small business status is depending on your industry, is based on your revenues, your average revenues over the last 3 years, or it's based on your average employee count over the last 12 months. And there's specific formulas, which I talk about in the book and which can be found in the regulations, that let you do that. And so depending on your business's status, it can be a little tricky. For example, if your business was just formed last year, for example, you might think, well, you know, the average of the last 3 years is zero on whatever I made last year. That's not true. They have a different formula when you haven't been in business those years that may mean that you cannot plug in the zeros and you're larger than you think you are. And so some folks do occasionally get tripped up by the counting, but that's not the trickiest part of determining whether you're a small business. In my experience, when I see folks who think they're small or self-certifying as small on government procurements, subcontracts, prime contracts, what have you, and then they get a size protest against them and it gets sustained and they lose their contracts, why does that happen? Most of the time, it's because of affiliation problems, whether that's general affiliation, which means that the SBA considers your company and another company to be affiliates for all purposes, or whether it's ostensible subcontractor affiliation, which is when the SBA says your company and its subcontractor have such a close relationship on a particular contract, or the subcontractor has too dominant a role on that contract, that we're going to consider you joint ventures for that procurement, just for that one procurement, but we're going to add your sizes together. So if you've got a large business sub, then all of a sudden your sizes are added together and you're out of luck for that procurement. So affiliation, I think, is the number one reason why small companies might not actually be small.
Okay, so venture-backed firm, venture-owned firms almost immediately disqualify?
You know, depending on the rules for size are pretty straightforward. Yeah, I mean, depending on your ownership is pretty much the first rule listed in the SBA's affiliation regulation says ownership. It's called common ownership. And what it says is that if the same owner owns the majority, essentially, of two firms, then those firms are going to be affiliated. 51% or more, they're automatically going to be affiliated. And there's really not many exceptions to that. There are a few exceptions in the regulations. For example, tribal-owned companies, Alaska Native corporations do have some exceptions from the affiliation rules, but they're very, very narrowly written. If the exemption isn't in the regulations, then common majority ownership will almost always result in affiliation.
Okay, so, and that would impact, obviously, the employee count and the revenue.
Correct. If investor A, let's call him Bob, for example, let's say he owns, 51% of one company and 100% of another company, each company has 200 employees, then in the SBA's eyes, both companies have 400 employees. It's no different than if either company had 400 employees on its own payroll, because they simply add them together when they're figuring out whether those companies meet a particular size standard.
Yeah, and you know, throughout the book, and I'm going to reference the book several times, you have these examples, literally, every couple of pages to illustrate these points, and they really help clarify. But you know, the cool thing is, like at the end of this particular chapter, we have the ostensible subcontractor affiliation risk questionnaire, and you've got 19 questions here. So it really enumerates all of the risk factors involved.
Yeah, I think that's really what I tried to do with the two chapters on affiliation, is to put risk questionnaires at the end of each chapter. And the reason for that is affiliation, both general affiliation and ostensible subcontractor affiliation, in most cases, is based on kind of a totality of the relationships between the parties. There are some hard and fast rules, such as the common majority ownership rule, But in a lot of cases, it simply depends on how many risk factors are present. And risk factors, by the way, is my own term. It's not an SBA term. How many risk factors are present and how severe those risk factors are. And so since those risk factors are not necessarily laid out in the regulations, in fact, a lot of them can only be found in the case law of the SBA's Office of Hearings and Appeals, which is the SBA administrative body that interprets these regulations. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of small government contractors go to bed at night reading SBA OHA decisions. And so I've kind of called from those to put together, from those and, of course, regulations as well, to put together a list of factors that small government contractors can look at and see whether a particular relationship that they may have with another business or with a subcontractor may be putting them at risk of affiliation.
Cool. And really, at the end of each chapter, you've got these checklists. We're going to get into woman-owned later on, but the woman-owned one, I had not seen a list that extensive anywhere before.
Yeah. Again, it's each chapter is meant really for small government contractors who want to take a deeper dive into the regulations and understand how the regulations and requirements work. But I also understand that these are folks who are running a business. I mean, they don't always have time to go in and closely read every last word I've written before they need to make a business decision. And so having summaries at the end, having checklists, and also I put at the end of each chapter a place where contractors can quickly find the citation for each regulation to see where these rules came from. So in case they want more information, they can obviously always reach out to me, but if they want to read the regulation itself, the citation's right there. They can Google it, find it very quickly.
Bingo. The book is The Small Business Guide to Government Contracts. The author is Steve Koprinz, my guest today. You are listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, and we'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is Steve Koprinz. He's a partner or an attorney, a contracts attorney at Pettifish, Immel, Heeb & Hurd. He will be in Kansas City in a month or so, but that does not mean you cannot contact him if you are a small biz or any biz seeking advice on government contracts. Steve, last week, the SBA released its scorecard on and
Small Business Procurement Scorecard, I believe, yeah. Is the official
and,
name.
And they gave the government a B for their efforts in small business contracting. My reading of your book and matching it against that report, that must be graded on a curve.
Yeah, I was surprised to see a B mark, but maybe I shouldn't have been because the press release that accompanied this report seemed slanted toward the positive. If you read the SBA press release by itself, you'd think the government had achieved great things this year in small business contracting. They'd, shouted from the rooftops about, $91.5 billion being awarded to small business. What the press release didn't mention is that last year there was $97.9 billion awarded to small business. And so there have been quite a decrease. And in fact, the government last year awarded 22.66% of contracts to small business. That's not the 23% goal that they were aiming for, but it was pretty close. And this year dipped more than a full percent to 21.65%. And that's quite a regression. And so I come, Mark, from a family of teachers. My mother and father are both teachers. My brother's a teacher, and I tell you, this kind of work would not be earning a B in their classes, I don't think.
No, and correct me if I'm wrong. I still hear rumblings from small businesses and others out there that a lot of these percentages here would not be as accurate if the size standards were actually applied.
Yeah, there's a lot of complaints about how the methodology has worked. There's a lot of complaints that from different small businesses and organizations around the country that really, if you look closely at who's actually a small business and how the size standards should be actually applied, that the numbers would be even lower. And I don't have personal knowledge as to whether that's correct or not, but I do know that there's a sense out there in the small business community that they're not necessarily getting a fair shake, or they're not necessarily getting what they had hoped for in terms of pushing for small businesses to hit that 23% and beyond. And I think these numbers back that up.
Well, and your blog, and again, the blog is smallgovcon.com. Your blog post on this from a week or so ago points out that the release date of this was July 3rd. Do you happen to know what time, you know, right before national holiday, do you happen to know what time of day it was released?
I believe it was somewhere around noon, something like that. It wasn't the very end of the day, but maybe it was the very end of the day for the folks who were releasing it. In my blog post, I actually mentioned, for those of us who were fans of The West Wing, an episode of The West Wing called Take Out the Trash Day, which was centered around a concept that in the Bartlett administration in The West Wing of releasing all the bad news in a bucket on Friday afternoon when no one was paying attention. And so it would only be printed in the papers on Saturday. And in the words of one of the characters, well, no one reads the paper on Saturday anyway. And so, you know, I saw this data come out on July 3rd, and I was, you know, call me a paranoid or a conspiracy theorist, but I wondered whether something similar was going on, that they knew it was bad news and just kind of wanted to push it out when folks were at the beach and not paying attention.
I understand trying to make your efforts look good, but this, you know, frankly, I view it as something along the lines of a bad joke.
Yeah, it's you know, the best you can say is that it's very disappointing for small business. You know, I talked to someone else who said, well, you know, I've heard from government folks that this is just a blip on the radar screen. You know, 1% is not that big a deal. And I said, wait a second, you tell me 1% of the federal procurement budget of approximately $500 billion is not a big deal? That's a big deal to me. And it's a big deal to the small businesses out there. And I also said, you know, if a 1% decrease isn't such a big deal, then why is it so hard to get a 1% increase? Why can't we go from last year's 22.6 to 23.6? And so I'd be curious to hear what the government's response would be to that, but so far I haven't heard much.
Okay. May I assume you're following any of the legislation regarding small business on the Hill at this point?
I was following as much as I can. I mean, there's been a lot out there this year, but we can talk about
how much of that is hyperbole and how much of it actually has teeth, do you think?
You know, there's things out there that I think are going to help small businesses, that I hope will help small businesses, that I think will help small businesses. I think the work with the GSA schedules to encourage set-asides under schedule contracts will actually be a helpful result for small businesses. The latest figures, I guess, said now that 15% of GSA schedule contracts are being set aside. That's not good enough, but it's better than was done in the past. And so if some of these multiple award vehicles and GSA schedule contracts, if set-asides can increase to small businesses under those, then hopefully that will help the overall procurement numbers. I do think there are some pieces of legislation on the Hill that are well-intended but are not necessarily going to either pass or achieve the results we want to see. And I think one of those right now is a push to increase the goals to 25%, and I think that's absolutely a laudable idea. But in my mind, if we can't even reach 23%, if agencies are not being held accountable, if the government's getting a B for hitting 21.6%, then where's the carrot and stick to get to 25? And so simply increasing the goals, in my mind, when we haven't even reached the 23%, simply isn't really going to provide substantive relief to small businesses.
Well, and we could also, and we probably should, get into the size standards when it comes to this. The SBA has been moving the size standards around for a couple of years now, and it's probably more than a couple of years. But, you know, every time I look into specific NAICS codes, I'm wondering, you know, where the heck do they come up with these numbers?
Yeah, I mean, the SBA has been doing a thorough review of the size standards. They've got some sort of complex methodology in place that involves mathematics that are way above my limits. I went to school to be a lawyer because I didn't want to take math classes. But I will tell you that from a layperson's perspective, some of these things either don't make sense or, you know, depending on when you look at a particular size standard, one day a small business may be small, the next day, you know, its competitor who was large is also small. And I know that that's happened in a number of NAICS codes. Recently, I think most notably Sector 54, which is where a lot of the service codes are located, saw a number of increases. I know a couple of size standards went increased. They doubled. In one case, I believe, went from $4 million to $19 million. That's great if you're an $18 million company, because now you qualify as small. But if you're one of those $3.9 million companies or $3.5 million companies, all of a sudden you're competing against companies five times your size, and you're pretty much out of luck.
Well, that's certainly one way to look at it. Let's wrap up on the scorecard. Ms. Velasquez from New York comes out with her scorecard every year, and I do not recall it ever reflecting anything that SBA comes out with.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect that it would this year either. I mean, the numbers, I think, in her scorecard are going to be probably more akin to what small businesses are feeling. And I highly doubt that she is going to be giving the government an overall above average or B grade for their efforts in small business contracting. I imagine that when her report is released, it will attempt to hold the agencies accountable for not achieving for small businesses what they should be achieving.
Okay. Do we have any idea? I mean, usually it's out by now.
It's not out as far as I know, and maybe it'll be out next week. But I have not heard. I have not heard anything.
Would love to hear from you again when it does. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The book, again, is The Small Business Guide to Government Contracts. The author is Steve Koprinz. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Steve Koprinz. He has written a recently released book from Amicom, The Small Business Guide to Government Contracts. Get the book. It's available everywhere. If you want to save like a buck, go to Books A Million, but you can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And if your local bookseller doesn't have it, tell them to get it. Because government contractors are everywhere, and those small businesses are everywhere, and they all need this book. Everybody in this market really needs this book. This is a great read. It's surprisingly easy read. But one chapter in this book deals with the woman-owned small business. And we've had some news recently on that. Tom Johnson of Set Aside Alert was here last week, and we talked briefly about woman-owned set-aside programs off to a slow start. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tom's absolutely right about that, and I would say that the numbers released on Tuesday by the SBA back up what Tom and others in the industry have been saying, that they're just not seeing the set-asides out there for women-owned small business. Now, remember, the women-owned small business program really was supposed to take off in the last year. This is the year that scorecard was supposed to be measuring. And so you'd expect that the set-aside numbers for women would have increased probably significantly over that year, because it's the first time we've had a set-aside program in place. Surprisingly to me, but perhaps not surprisingly to those in the industry who've been paying attention to the number of set-asides being issued, the women-owned small business numbers actually decreased slightly. They went from a little over 4% to a little under 4% in the same year that this women-owned small business program was supposed to be setting aside opportunities for WOSBs. So extremely disappointing result, I think, on that front.
Sure, especially if you're a woman-owned business.
If you're a woman-owned business and you thought that this program was going to provide you with the opportunities that you've been waiting for to get to that 5% and beyond in the federal market, then last year's numbers at least have to be a punch in the gut.
I would think. Anything else on woman-owned right now? Because I want to get into the vets too.
That's really what we're seeing, is just that the set-asides are not happening. Hopefully these numbers will push that forward. I would say the one other thing that I did see recently is that the SBA Office of Hearings and Appeals heard its first eligibility appeal on a woman-owned small business procurement. It didn't go well for the woman-owned small business. They lost the appeal. And so just a reminder that when you do see that set aside out there for women-owned small business or economically disadvantaged women-owned small business, the EDWSB, competitors can protest your status. And it doesn't matter if you've been certified by a third-party certifier or submitted the right documents to the document repository. If everything's not perfect, you can and will lose your contract. So be aware of that possibility within the WOSB program.
Well, that leads me to one other thing before we get into the veteran-owned small business. At the beginning of your book, you point out, or you remind those of us who should have known this or should have remembered this anyway, small businesses have, especially those looking for small business set-aside business, there's more regulations there than for large contractors.
Yeah, I think in many cases that's absolutely right. I mean, you're talking about an area of in government contracting that's highly regulated to begin with, but within the small business field, you're dealing with FAR Part 19 regulations, and you're also dealing with the SBA's size, affiliation, and then individual program regulations, such as the Women-Owned Small Business Program, HUB Zone, Service-Disabled Veteran, and 8A program regulations. And those are very complex, and they're not regulations that the large companies need to worry about.
Well, you see, in my mind, that actually does level the playing field. If you envision the playing field with this giant steamroller and small businesses in front of it getting smushed into the turf, now the playing field is level. You just don't see the small
right,
businesses
you just
anymore.
Where are
man, what a mess. So another mess, veteran preference businesses.
Yeah, I mean, talk about messy. I mean, you know, if you're a service disabled veteran owned small business, or you know someone who is working with one, you've probably heard a lot of frustrations for them over the last couple years with how this program is working. I'd say program, it's actually two programs. There's two separate but equal programs, really. There's the VAs.
Separate but equal. I've heard that before.
Yeah, separate, but it didn't work very well that time either.
And, right.
You know, in this case, we've got the Veterans Administration is now running its own program based on legislation enacted, I believe, in 2006, and that's the CVE, the VetViz, the whole certification mess that we're seeing. And then, but for non-VA contracts, they're still falling under the SBA's SDVOSB program, and that's still a self-certification program. The rules and regulations are similar between the two, but they're not identical, and that trips up folks as well who've been self-certifying perhaps for years under non-VA contracts. They want to go get certified, and the VA turns them down, either because they've been incorrectly self-certifying, which happens a lot, or because the VA's regs in a couple spots have borrowed really from the 8A program's regulations and are stricter than the SBA's regulations.
Okay. Now, can you still certify as a veteran-owned business if you're not disabled?
There's within the VA only, there is a separate component for VOSBs, and that's veteran-owned small businesses who are not service-disabled. What that VA certification, it's actually a certification program, it does let you obtain contracts as a VOSB. It's lower priority than SDVOSB. In other words, if there's two or more SDVOSBs who can perform the work, they're going to give them to them first. But if there's not, the next tier down is going to be your VOSBs. But there's nothing similar in the rest of the government right now. It's just the VA.
Okay. But I mean, you know, we have the SBA program and the CVE program. Is it possible to certify under each? And if so, how much paperwork, how much time and effort and money does that cost a business to do?
To certify under the VA's program, it used to take a long time. The VA has been reducing its backlog, but it's still not perfect. I mean, you're going to be looking at least 90 days probably to get your application certified. That's the time clock that they're supposed to be using under the regulations. Sometimes they take longer. And there's no guarantees that they're going to say yes when you submit your paperwork. There's lots of pitfalls, and I try to address these in the chapter of the book addressing SDVOSBs. There's lots of pitfalls when they look at your paperwork, and even legal issues. For example, contractors who are located in a number of Western states, primarily California, et cetera, they may not be aware that if they are married, their spouse is legally considered to own half the company. And if someone else owns half the company who's not an SDV, a service-disabled veteran, the service-disabled veteran doesn't control the company. And so you've got a married veteran in California who owns 100% of his company, and they're getting their applications turned down because their spouse is considered to own 50%. Now, there's paperwork you can do to fix it, but most veterans don't realize that until they've already been turned down.
And then do they have to go through the entire process again? Can they go through the entire process again?
They can. There's two ways to do it. One is called a reconsideration. You can file a request for reconsideration. It's usually faster than doing a full reapplication. If your initial application was simply a complete mess, they may not accept your application. You can make minor fixes to your paperwork in a request for reconsideration. If you need to do something major, then you need to reapply the full way. And in that case, you may be back looking at the entire process again.
Okay. So once again, the onus on the small business is paperwork intent, regulations out the wazoo, technical phrase. How long legitimately would it take, do you think, for a service-disabled, veteran-owned small biz to go through all of this?
In terms of creating the paperwork and going through the application process, I would budget it at least 4 or 5 months. I would give it 6 if you have the time. That means that you have the time not only to create the paperwork that you may need, submit it to the SBA, let the SBA, excuse me, the VA deal with it, within hopefully the 90-day window that they're supposed to, but it may take longer. Mm-hmm. And then you still have time for a request for reconsideration if you need to do one. And the thing is that if you've got a particular contract opportunity with the VA coming up on the horizon down the road and you're not in their database, you need to start doing it, going through the process right away. Because if you're not in the database at the time they make that award, you're not eligible.
Yeah. And when you're advising companies, do you advise them to go through the VA and SBA process concurrently? Is one worth more than the other?
Well, the SBA process, Mark, right now is still a self-certification regime. There's no such thing as an SBA VA certification. And so to be at SDVO on a non-VA procurement, you simply self-certify that you qualify. Now, that has its own pitfall, and that is if you're not right, if you get it wrong, which happens a lot, the VA, it's not like the VA where they come back to you and say, why don't you fix your paperwork and try again? You get an eligibility protest and they take your contract away. And so it's an easier process paperwork-wise, but the risks are higher as well.
What a mess. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Steve Coprince. The book is The Small Business Guide to Government Contracts. Get it. Back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is Steve Coprince. Steve is a small business contracts attorney at Pettifish, Imohib and Heard, and he is the author of a book that everybody who listens to this show should get, The Small Business Guide to Government Contracts. I can't say that enough. I mean, number one, it sounds boring as hell. Mine didn't sound exciting, selling government yawn. But Steve's is a very easy read. It's extremely informative, and we're going to get into a little bit of the nitty-gritty here deeper. Subcontracting is a way that a lot of businesses come into the government market. The Amex Open study has highlighted this for a couple of years. You get a GSA schedule, but 30% of the GSA schedule holders make little or nothing. They're competing against entrenched vendors, which is probably why the set asides on schedules aren't doing great. But give me some of the pitfalls for especially subcontracting.
Sure. Subcontracting, again, it is a great way to get into the government marketplace. I think a lot of contractors, that's how they build their initial experience and past performance, is by coming in as a subcontractor to a larger company on an unrestricted procurement. There are, of course, some pitfalls involved in subcontracting. When you're subcontracting with a government prime contractor as opposed to just a contractor in the commercial world, a lot of small businesses don't realize that many of the FAR requirements actually do apply to them. And so they need to take a look at their subcontract, take a look at the FAR, and if you've never heard of the FAR before, this is the time to get started. Not when you get your first prime contract, but now, because the FAR has a lot of provisions that say, prime contractors, you need to put this in all your subcontracts. And by the way, if you don't put it in your subcontract, some of them say, we're going to consider it to be in there anyway. And so even government subcontractors may be required to have ethics plans, may be required to adopt affirmative action plans, engage in certain other behaviors that they may not have had to do in the commercial world. And so that's one aspect of subcontracting with a government prime contractor that's different. And I think also it's common for folks to take a look at subcontracting and to not really make a distinction between a teaming agreement and a subcontract. And teaming agreement is what the prime contractor will first give you. It's just basically an agreement where you're going to join their team to go after a piece of government work. And that basically is the roadmap for how you're going to work together to obtain the contract. But it's not the roadmap for how you're going to work together once you get the contract. That's your subcontract. And there are a number of pitfalls in teaming agreements. I think most importantly, as we've seen in recent news items pointing out that not all subcontractors get work under their teaming agreements with large subs, and this is something I know from experience. If at all possible, put in that teaming agreement that you're guaranteed to get some work, or you can leave the team and go with someone else. And that I don't see in nearly enough teaming agreements.
Okay, now that brings up the exclusivity point. Most, if not all, primes initially ask for in their teaming agreements an exclusive. Is there any pushback if a company says no?
There often is. I mean, prime contractors, large prime contractors, are used to kind of driving the bus here. I mean, they're used to being in charge. That doesn't mean you can't push back. As a small business, especially if you've got socioeconomic certifications, you're bringing something to the table that this prime contractor wants. They've got subcontracting plans with the federal agency. They've got goals that they've got to meet themselves, and they're coming to you to help them get there. And so negotiating with a large prime contractor can be a bit of a daunting task, but it often can lead to better teaming agreements and better subcontractors when you actually stand up to them instead of just crossing your fingers and hoping that they will treat you nicely signing their standard agreement.
Okay. Well, the advice that I've given for years and when I'm talking to business development program managers at major firms, they usually indicate they don't want companies leading with their socioeconomic status. They want companies leading with whatever technical capabilities they have. What's your strength?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, but keep in mind that although that they would prefer a company that's, you know, SDB or SDVO that has great technical capabilities, in the end, they just also want that certification that they can point you to the procuring agency as well. And so you should not be selling in the business of selling your certification. You should be selling what you do and what you do well. But on the flip side, don't be afraid to point out that while you're doing what you do well, you're helping them by bringing something to the table in terms of what they need to fulfill their subcontracting plan goals.
Okay. Now, as I've been a small business for a really, really long time, but I'm not a contractor, so it doesn't apply to me. But I'm used to operating my business the way I want. And I can do that because I'm a sole proprietor and I get to push myself around. That's it. I don't have employees. I have a couple of 1099s. And they put up with me because they actually can intuit what I actually need done. But when you're a small contractor, you cannot do things the way you're used to doing them. You mentioned briefly the ethics plan. What is this and what do small companies need to know about this?
Sure. And that's absolutely right. I mean, as a small government contractor, your company now really has two bosses, you and Uncle Sam, because you're both kind of running this company. And the ethics plan is one example. There's a section of the FAR that says that all government contractors should have ethics plans and separately says that you can be debarred or suspended if you don't have one. So what I read that as saying is effectively you must have an ethics plan. And there's nothing in the FAR that specifies exactly what must be in an ethics plan. In my book, I go through some things that you should consider putting in it. Essentially, the way the rules are written, the larger and more sophisticated you are, the better your ethics plan needs to be. But even the small mom-and-pop type business that's contracting with the government should have a written ethics plan that their employees should be required to read, sign, indicate that they will abide by it. And I would also encourage periodic ethics training. And this is really not only to ensure that your employees do behave ethically, which of course you want in any business, but that if the government ever comes to you and says, boy, you know, here's something we think that you did that we're not sure if it was ethical, what did you do to prevent this from happening? you can say, well, you know, I had my employees do A, B, and C. You know, I'm a small business. What more did you really want? And I think that would go a long way toward, mitigating any sort of problems that you might have if the government thinks there was some sort of ethical misconduct.
Okay. Now, along those same lines, we have the hiring and firing of employees. And I know that there's a number of mistakes that contractors, especially small businesses, can and probably frequently do make.
That's absolutely right. Again, once you're entering the government marketplace, there are certain things that you need to do when it comes to hiring, firing, disciplining, and also paying your employees. And I go through this in the book, but there are, for example, specific things that you must put in your employment advertisements. You must say, for example, you're an equal opportunity employer. You must list your positions with certain organizations. You can't just hand an open position to your cousin because you think they'll do a good job. You actually have to list it. These are what the government considers non-discrimination and obligations. There are also, if you get to a certain level, it's 50 employees, you have to adopt affirmative action plans. And you may think, well, affirmative action, you know, isn't that for colleges and universities and that sort of thing? Well, it's also for government contractors after you get to a certain level, and it's 50 employees in which you have to have affirmative action plans for minorities, individuals with disabilities, women, and also certain veterans. And so folks often don't realize that they have these sorts of obligations. And the final one is wages and benefits. You know, you may be used to saying, well, you know, I pay my employees minimum wage or better, and I'm good to go. That's not the case if you're covered by the Service Contract Act or the Davis-Bacon Act, which appear in many federal contracts and require prevailing wages and benefits, which are typically much higher than minimum wage.
Okay. Final thoughts.
Final thoughts is essentially that compliance is important. This, you know, I wrote this book because I had a number of small government contracts clients who came to me with issues, and I wished that I had a time machine to go back and tell them some of the things that were in this book before they called me, because I couldn't fix the problem. I could only do what I could to explain it away. So if you're a government contractor, think about your compliance issues now, not when a problem has already reared its head. And I think that in looking at compliance now and becoming aware of what the rules and regulations are, you'll not only be more comfortable in the market, but I think that it will help you grow your business, because you'll gain a reputation as a knowledgeable, ethical, and compliant contractor.
There you go. Steve, thank you so much for coming in. The guest is Steve Koprince. The book is The Small Business Guide to Government Contracts. The blog is smallgovcon.com. The blog is updated a couple of times a week. I'd suggest you put this on your read list too. And it's usually only, you know, half a dozen or so paragraphs, so it's a quick read. Important stuff. Stay up to date on it. Steve, again, thanks for coming in. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
This is not my day job. If your company needs to ensure its marketing program is paying top dividends, give me a call. You can find me at federaldirect.net. You can also find me all over LinkedIn. And thank you for listening to AmTower Off-Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, Monday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.